This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Woody Allen. He has a new movie that's partly an old movie. Woody Allen wrote the screenplay for his new film, Whatever Works, in the 70s. The leading role was written for Zero Mostel, but Allen put the screenplay aside after Mostel died in 1977, the year Annie Hall was released. Last year, when Woody Allen was ready to start a new film, he faced the possibility of an actor strike. He wanted to finish shooting a new movie before the threatened strike, but that left him no time to write a new screenplay. So he dusted off the one he wrote years ago for Zero Mostel and cast Larry David in the leading role. Larry David plays Boris Yelnikov, a former Columbia University professor who came close to winning a Nobel Prize in quantum mechanics. He's as misanthropic as he is brilliant. He hates most adults, and he hates children, which is bad news for the children who come to him for chess lessons. In this scene, Boris is sitting in a cafe when he's confronted by the mother of one of his chess students.
You! I have been looking for you. I want to talk to you.
Who are you?
Did you pick up a chessboard full of pieces and hit my son with it at his lesson today?
That idiot's your son? Do me a favor. Don't send that cretin to me anymore. I can't teach an empty-headed zombie chess.
I will have you know that he is a very bright child.
In your opinion. In your opinion, which is skewed because he's your unfortunate issue.
So you threw a chessboard at him?
I didn't throw it at him. I picked up the board and dumped the pieces on his head. As an object lesson to shake him out of his vegetable torpor.
You wait till my husband gets back from Florida.
What's he doing in Florida without you?
Punch you in the nose.
Her husband's in Fort Lauderdale. He's probably hanging out with the naked co-eds on spring break. He tells her it's a business trip. Your son's an imbecile. Teach him tiddlywinks, not chess.
One day, Boris finds a teenaged runaway named Melody, played by Evan Rachel Wood, sitting in front of his Manhattan home, begging for some food. He reluctantly takes her in, she stays, and they eventually marry, in spite of the approximately 40-year age difference between them, and in spite of the fact that Boris thinks she's brainless. At the start of the film, Boris states his philosophy of life, which is, life is short, so take what little pleasure you can get in this chamber of horrors. It's a philosophy expressed in several Woody Allen movies. Here's Woody Allen at the beginning of Annie Hall.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill Mountain resort, and one of them says, boy, the food at this place is really terrible. The other one says, yeah, I know, and such small portions. Well, that's essentially how I feel about life, full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly.
That basic philosophy is restated in Woody Allen's recent film, Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Here's Javier Bardem inviting two beautiful American tourists, Vicky and Cristina, to spend the weekend with him.
We'll spend the weekend. I mean, I'll show you around the city and we'll eat well, we'll drink good wine, we'll make love.
Yeah, who exactly is going to make love?
Hopefully the three of us.
Oh, my God.
I'll get your bill.
Jesus, this guy, he doesn't beat around the bush. Look, senor, maybe in a different life.
Why not? Life is short, life is dull, life is full of pain, and this is a chance for something special.
Woody Allen, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, it's interesting.
Hi.
at least three of your films kind of start with the same premise. I'm wondering, why has this question framed several of your movies, that life is hard, life is full of pain, but life is short, so do what you can to get some pleasure?
Well, this is hardly an original thought with me. I mean, down through the ages, all the important writers and all the important philosophers have, in one form or another, come to the conclusion, the obvious conclusion, that life is a terrible trial and very harsh and very full of suffering. And so whatever you can do with the stipulation that you don't hurt anybody without, you know, ruining a life here or there or causing any damage, there's nothing wrong with it.
So when we talk about making movies, does that give you pleasure? Like, what's the ratio of pleasure and pain in making a film?
Well, you know, it's a different kind of pain. It's, you see, making a movie is a great distraction from the real agonies of the world. It's an overwhelmingly, you know, difficult thing to do. You've got to deal with actors and temperaments and scripts and second acts and third acts and camera work and costumes and sets and editing and music. And, you know, it's a, there's enough in that to keep you distracted almost all the time. And if I'm locked into a, what would appear to be a painful situation because half my movie works, let's say, and the whole second half of it doesn't work, or a character in my movie is terrible, or you don't believe the love story or something, these are all problems that are, or generally are, solvable with reshooting, with editing, with thinking, diagnosing what's wrong. And they distract you from the real problems of life, which are unsolvable and very painful problems. Also, in the problems of movie making, if you don't solve your problem, all that happens to you is that your movie bombs. So the movie's terrible. So people don't come to see it. Critics don't like it. The public doesn't like it. This is hardly a terrible punishment in life compared to what you're given out in the real world of human existence.
So may I ask, what are some of the real problems that making movies distracts you from?
Well, they distract me from the same problems that that you face or that anyone faces. You know, the uncertainty of life and inevitability of aging and death of loved ones and mass killings and starvations and holocausts and not just the man-made carnage, but the existential position that you're in, you know, being in a world where you have no idea what's going on, why you're here, or what possible meaning your life can have, and the conclusion that you come to after a while, that there is really no meaning to it, and it's just a random, meaningless event. And these are pretty depressing thoughts, and if you spend much time thinking about them, not only can't you resolve them, but you sit frozen in your seat. You can't even get up to have your lunch. So it's better to, you know, distract yourself. And people distract themselves creatively, you know, in the arts. They distract themselves in business or by following baseball teams and worrying over batting averages and who wins the pennant. And these are all things that that you do and focus on rather than sit home and worry.
So we've talked about how your characters try to find pleasure in a life full of pain. My impression of you is that you're the kind of person for whom pleasure is hard to come by, in part because you've said you're claustrophobic, agoraphobic. Annie Hall was originally going to be named anhedonia, which means an inability to experience pleasure. Is pleasure hard to come by even when you're working to find it?
Uh-huh. I do. There are a number of things that give me pleasure. But you know, hanging over the pleasure is always the dark cloud of you know, the human predicament, so that I can get pleasure when I'm playing with my children or I'm doing something with my wife. Or playing jazz. I like to play music. And I do find it pleasurable, but these are transient oases in a vast desert of unspeakable gloom, you know. But I do get pleasure like everyone else. It's pleasurable for me to go to a basketball game or, you know, but always overriding it is the notion that it's, you know, ephemeral, very, very ephemeral.
Now, your new movie, Whatever Works, was written a long time ago by you for Zero Mostel to star in. What year did you write it?
I don't remember the exact year, but it must have been the 70s. You know, I mean, I wrote it years ago, threw it in the drawer. And then I took it out because I needed a script quickly because there was going to be, possibly going to be, an actor strike. And so I couldn't work on a script. I had to have a script quickly to do a picture before that potentially imminent strike occurred. So I took it out of my drawer, and I felt it was quite a good story, and unfortunately Zero had been unique, and it was very hard to think of anyone to play that role. And over the years, decades, it occurred to us, Juliet Taylor and myself, that
she's your casting director.
Casting director, yeah. That Larry David could probably do this in a very, very funny way.
The character that Larry David plays is a real misanthrope, and unlike some of your other earlier characters, he's not self-deprecating, he's not insecure. In fact, he thinks he's a genius, a kind of superior being. And in that respect, you're almost like leaving out the likable part, because what we identify with in your earlier characters, and I mentioned the early characters because that's the period that you wrote the script, is that they had these insecurities, they were self-deprecating. So I guess I'm wondering why you made this character so condescending to other people, somebody who thinks he's a genius.
Well, this was supposed to be for Zero originally, and he was a big, fat, blustering guy who thought that he had all the answers and thought that everybody in life was inferior to him.
You think Zero Mostel himself was that way?
No, not Zero himself. The character that Zero was playing.
Yeah.
Actually, Zero was quite the opposite of that. But it was a big, blustering character who had no patience with anybody. But of course, when you look at the character is full of self-doubt and full of anxiety and can't fend for himself and can't function in relationships. He's really no different. It's just that his facade is, if I had written that years ago for myself, the character that I could play with my limited range was self-deprecating, and the persona that I always felt comfortable acting out was that kind of a intimidated victim-style character. But at the time, that was not the story. The story was written not for me, but for Zero, and so it would be the difference between having someone like Groucho Marx or W.C. Fields play a character and Charlie Chaplin play a character. One is more persecuted and victim-like, and the other two are much more insulting and condescending and superior.
So why did you feel so at home playing the self-deprecating character and felt like that was your comfort zone?
I don't know. You're just born into it, I guess.
Born into self-deprecation?
I'm not an actor, and I don't have a big range. I mean, I could not play, Shakespeare. There's certain things I feel comfortable doing, and I can't explain why. I just do. Yes, in life, I think I am self-deprecating and frightened of everything, and it's an area that I feel comfortable making jokes about, because I'm always joking about my personal foibles.
In the movie, Larry David is in his 50s, and Evan Rachel Wood is still in her teens when she shows up kind of homeless on his doorstep, and he decides, kind of against his will and against his better judgment, to take her in and give her a few meals and then to let her live there, and then they get married. So forgive me for asking this, because this is a little personal, but this was written before, like long before you married Sun Yi. But it means, let's be honest, that everyone's going to be looking for clues in this movie about your relationship with your wife. And and again, let's be honest, a lot of your fans were really kind of upset when you married the woman who was the adoptive daughter of your longtime lover. So I wonder if you thought about that kind of thing when you were making the movie, that people would just be like looking for clues about the older man, younger woman relationship and how
people,
that applies to you.
People do look for clues in my movies all the time.
For who you really
are.
Movies,
They're constantly searching for clues in my movies. And no matter how many times I've told them over the years that, you know, I make these stories up. Some of them I've made up with other writers. I've worked with Doug McGrath, with Marshall Brickman, with Mickey Rose. They make up stories. They make up half of the story with me. The people always look for clues in my movies, and they think based on my movies that they know me. And, of course, they don't know me. And there are some things you could have learned about me over the years, but not much, really. You know, I was never who anybody thought I was from when I started. When I first started as a comic in Greenwich Village, people thought that I was, at that time, some kind of a little beatnik and someone who, was a kind of mousy intellectual, and you know, none of these things were ever true. I never lived in the village. I always lived in a very nice neighborhood uptown in Manhattan. I was never intellectual. I was never interested in intellectual things. You know, when I explain to people, I'm the guy that you see in his T-shirt with a beer watching the baseball game at night at home on television, they find that hard to square with the characters that I've played in the movies. But in the movies, I'm just acting. So it doesn't bother me, but it is something that I've tried to be honest about over the years and explain to people, but they don't feel comfortable hearing it. They listen to it, and either they don't believe me when I say it, or they don't want to believe me because it diminishes their enjoyment, or it's important that they have some kind of image of me that's meaningful to them for some reason. I don't know why, but I've never been. You know, I was always a very athletic little boy, always never a loner or a loser, always the first one picked on any team.
You were the first one picked on any team?
Always.
See, I wouldn't have believed that.
I know. I was always
very counter to your image.
Very good athlete. I was interested even in playing professional baseball. I was, won track medals. But nobody thinks of me that way. They think of me as, some kind of little bookworm, because I have these big black glasses, black rimmed glasses, and they think of me as a bookworm and give me more credit for intellect than I have. And, I couldn't make it through college. I couldn't make it through my freshman year of college. And this was not because I was some artist or intellectual above it. I couldn't cut it. I mean, I wasn't.
You flunked out?
Couldn't get them. I flunked out. I was thrown out of New York University in my first year there.
What did you fail?
Because I couldn't get the marks.
In what subjects?
I was a motion picture production major. I had to take regular subjects as well.
Don't tell me you failed motion
English
picture classes.
And Spanish and subjects like that. I failed those subjects. And I didn't do well in motion picture production either.
Was this because you were busy writing jokes for other people?
I wasn't too busy. I was uninterested. I mean, I played ball. I was, as I say, I was athletic. I played cards. I liked to. I wasn't interested in and erudition and education. Those are not things that I was not brought up to be interested in that, and I wasn't interested. You know, I didn't see it in my home. And this is long-winded, but just to say that people have, you know, are constantly looking for clues to me in my work and seizing on things that are quite unrepresentative of who I really am.
Can you describe the neighborhood you grew up in? A lot of people imagine you growing up under the roller coaster in Coney Island, like your character in
Annie
Hall.
Right. People think that. No, I grew up in a very nice section of Brooklyn called Flatbush. And when I grew up there, it was a lovely, you know, it was a lovely section. I mean, there was ball field and playground. There were many, many, many movie houses within, you know, walking distance of, no matter where you were dropped, you'd be within walking distance of a couple of movie houses. And the school that I went to was, you know, quite a nice school. And, you know, the blocks were tree-lined and safe, and you could go out and play ball all day long in the streets and schoolyards. And it was a very nice neighborhood. There was, you know, I was not deprived, and I didn't grow up poor.
What was your parents' relationship like, and what did you make? What did it make you think marriage was like?
Marriage for my parents was kind of like what it was in all the other neighboring houses and friends' houses. It was a long truce, is what it was. All the parents in the neighborhood, the men and women, they loved each other. There were people who were from the Depression, and so money was a big factor because nobody had any real money and everybody had to work. But usually what would happen is the men and the women would, the guys would work all day and they'd come home, and then on the weekends, the guys would take bridge chairs out and play cards at a table, and the women would keep with the women. There was no sense that a guy was coming home on the weekend so he could take his wife and, you know, leave the son with a babysitter or the daughter with a babysitter and check into a hotel and have a romantic weekend or do something romantic. There wasn't that. The guys would be, you know, watching the ball game, or not watching so much, listening on the radio to the ball games together. They'd be playing poker or gin rummy or pinochle together. And that's how it was even when there was a dinner or something. The uncles and relatives would get together. And as soon as the dinner was over, the guys would be in the other room around a card table. And the women would be talking in their room about, you know, and you didn't get a sense, you didn't come away with a sense of romantic passion. There wasn't much interpersonal charm to it.
I know that your movies aren't your life, but there's a scene in Annie Hall that is just like so funny, and I feel like I know these people. It's the dinner scene where you're at dinner with Diane Keaton, Annie Hall's family, and it's a much more kind of formal, you know, quiet, polite, everybody eating slowly kind of setting. And you compare that in your mind with the family dinners you were used to, where people are like shoveling down the food and hollering at each other and everybody's aggravated and talking about who has diabetes. Was dinner like that at home?
Dinner was not really like that at home, no, because, you know, I ate by myself at, 5:30, and my mother ate at 6:30 after she had made dinner for my sister and myself. And my father got home at 8:45, and he would have that stuff was made up and exaggerated for comic purposes.
How come you ate alone?
I ate alone because I like to eat alone, because I like, you know, I like the solitude. I like to, you know, eat and read a comic book or something. And
your parents let you do that without accusing you of being antisocial and turning your back on the family?
They were so happy that I wanted to eat alone. You know, no, because we always lived with aunts and uncles and things, and my mother would have a better time eating with her sister, or if my father got home in time and she was waiting for him, with him. But, you know, what am I going to talk about with my mother? I was 10 years old, or 9 or 11, and out in the streets all day playing stickball, and, you know, we had nothing to talk about.
Now, you started in comedy by writing jokes, and you were writing for an older generation. Were you writing jokes that you couldn't imagine telling yourself, but that you were writing for the comics who would be telling them?
Yeah, I couldn't imagine being in front of an audience. I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be, again, alone in my room, not bothered by anybody, not in front of an audience. And so I never saw myself performing.
What was the pay like? Did they pay you per joke or per joke that they used?
No, the pay was a lot. I mean, at the time, you know, when you think that my father and mother both had to work their whole life. My father drove a cab and was a bartender, was a bookmaker, and ran a pool room. My mother always worked in the flower market. They had to combine their salaries. And I started working. And you know, their combined salaries would be, you know, maybe less than $100 a week combined. And I started working. And immediately I was making close to $200 a week. I was 17 years old and I was making that. And before long, I was making $1,500 a week. And in those days, I mean, this was the early 50s.
So, that was a lot of money.
You know, the mid-50s. And it was more than my parents put together would make in ages. So the show business salaries, I always felt were way out of whack with reality. Now, I haven't made a big protest over that over the years, you'll notice. But I always did feel that they were, you know, when you see what a school teacher gets and some terrible comedian gets or some awful singer gets, you know, it's shocking.
Did you say your father worked in a pool room and he was a bookmaker?
Yeah, my father had a lot of jobs. He was always scuffling to make a living. He sold jewelry. He was a waiter. He was a bartender. He was a cab driver. He ran a pool room. He was a bookmaker for a while.
You must have met a lot of colorful characters through him, unless you were not welcome in that world.
I was young to have met the colorful characters, but he was always bringing home stolen merchandise. And, you know, that was fenced to him for no money at all. So he'd always be coming home with, you know, a fur coat for my mother or a typewriter or a tape recorder or this, you know, and pick this up for $2 and this up for $20. And, you know, there was a lot of that over the years, a lot of stuff bought. I remember that, you know, fence junk.
Were you supposed to keep that a secret, that it was fenced?
It was never expressed that way. It was, you know, it was that he came home with a bargain and,
right.
You know, that, and you say, my God, where did you get that, you know, electric typewriter for $1.25? It's brand new. And, you know, but you never knew that. And my father was an inveterate numbers player. There was not a day in his life that he didn't play the numbers. And whenever he won, you know, it was money for everybody. I mean, he just spread it around, you know, like Jackie Gleason and the Honeymooners. I mean, he just, everybody, you know, it was such a pleasure if he came home and had hit his number. You know, my sister and I and my mother all knew we were going to be rewarded with an extravagant bonus.
Several of your characters have had, to one degree or another, a dose of hypochondria. And I'm thinking like you've definitely reached the age where people get real symptoms. And, you know, as you get older, as we all know, there are certain insults to the body. And I guess I'm wondering what it's like for you to deal with the body's aging process.
Well, first off, let me say, you know, you get insults to your body all the time.
I mean,
you're always working on the abyss. And I was never a hypochondriac. I never have imagined that I get a sickness or a disease. My problem was being an alarmist. That is, if I get chapped lips, I think it's, you know, brain cancer. You know, so
yeah.
It's that I immediately go to the worst permutation possible. And as I've gotten older, I so far haven't really gotten any terrible problems that I know of. I want to qualify that. So I haven't really experienced much breakdown. I've lost some hearing, and I have a hearing aid that I use. I don't have to use it all the time because I haven't lost that much, but I'm much more fun to be with if I have it on. But I haven't started to seriously break down yet, and I'm hoping that it either never happens to me, that science always keeps one step ahead of me, or that I just die in my sleep one evening and then I never experience some terrible breakdown in my body.
Now, just one more question, and again, this is kind of personal, but it's really more about your movies, I think. After you married Sun Yi, I think a lot of people went back and rewatched Manhattan or thought about Manhattan because it's the story of an older man and a younger woman, a middle-aged man and a teenager. And the ending of that movie was always ambiguous to me. I could never really tell whether you thought that the character you played when he finally, after telling the Marielle Hemingway character to leave and go on the trip to Europe to study and that, you know, she'd be better off doing that and leaving him. And then at the end, he kind of begs her to stay. Like, was he doing, in your mind, the right thing? I mean, like, what did you think of that character?
I had no idea. Marshall Brickman and I wrote that together, and we've tried to figure out some kind of ending for the picture. We would have been happy to write any ending on the picture that would have worked, that they stayed together, that they didn't stay together, that you couldn't tell. To me, it didn't matter. I mean, I had no special feelings about that. We were looking at the beginning of the movie for some rich areas to get comic scenes in, and one of the areas that we came up with a few, and one of the areas was the older guy and the younger girl, but that had no relation to my life at the time, and it was nothing that was of any particular interest to me or to him. It was just a good laugh gimmick, a good romantic gimmick. So I really don't know, you know, what happens at the end. I mean, I remember the ending, but I never knew, and we never cared. We knew we could end it that way, and it had an effective, dramatic punch to the audience, and we moved on.
When people love somebody's art, they become very interested in the artist, and that leads them to be interested in the artist's personal life or what they can find out about it. And like some of your fans felt just upset and in some ways even betrayed maybe because of your marriage to Sun Yi, and they started reevaluating, well, do I see his films differently now? Do you think it's fair or wrong to evaluate an artist's work by decisions they've made or what you think of decisions they've made in their personal life? Or do you think that that's...
I think you can evaluate an artist any way you choose to. You're free to evaluate an artist in any way that you want to, based on anything that makes you happy.
And do you care what people think of your personal life? Or is that just irrelevant to you?
Well, do you care? You know, if I say I don't care, it sounds so cold and callous. But let me put it this way. How could you go through life, taking direction from the outside world. I mean, what kind of life would you have, you know, if you made your decisions based on, you know, the outside world and not what your inner dictates told you? You would have a very inauthentic life.
So you told us you didn't eat with your family. Do you eat when you were growing up that you ate alone because you like to be alone with your comic book at dinner?
Yeah.
And your parents preferred the company of adults. Do you eat with your children now?
I eat with the children, yeah, but because they like our company, you know, and the generations are different. I'm much closer to my children than my parents were to me. You know, I'm more of a friend to my children. My wife is more of a friend to my children than my parents were. You know, when I grew up, the parents were much removed in the hierarchy of, you know, the social ladder, the family ladder. And so, you know, my parents were one thing and I was something else. And we had nothing in common to talk about. But, you know, my kids and I and my wife, you know, talk about the same subjects and you know, we're all friends. So it's a different tenor to the relationship. But that's something that has evolved in general over the years. Younger parents are are different with their children than the older generation parents. Now, I'm an older parent, but I'm still a parent in a younger generation than the generation that I grew up in, obviously. I do eat with my children, and we like it.
One more question. Of all the movies that you've seen, what movie have you seen the most times?
What movie have I seen the most times?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I've seen, I'd have to name three movies that I've seen many, many, many times. I've seen The Seventh Seal many, many times. I've seen The Bicycle Thief many, many, many times. And I've seen Shane many, many, many times. Because those are three of my favorites. Now, I have other favorites that I like equally, but I haven't seen them quite as much as I've seen these.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Woody Allen's new movie, Whatever Works, stars Larry David. Here's Woody Allen in a scene toward the end of his 1979 movie, Manhattan, in which he played a comedy writer. He's alone in his apartment, lying on the couch, dictating notes into a cassette machine.
An idea for a short story about people in Manhattan who were constantly creating these real unnecessary neurotic problems for themselves because it keeps them from dealing with more unsolvable, terrifying problems about the universe. It has to be optimistic. All right, why is life worth living? That's a very good question. Well, there are certain things I guess that make it worthwhile. Like what? Okay. For me, I would say, Groucho Marx, to name one thing, and Willie Mays, and the second movement of the Jupiter Symphony, and Louis Armstrong, recording of Potato Head Blues, Swedish movies, naturally, Sentimental Education by Flaubert, Marlon Brando, Frank Sinatra, those incredible Apples and Pears by Cezanne, The Crabs at Sam Woe's, Tracy's Face.
We've heard a lot about how our current economic condition parallels that of the Great Depression. Book critic Maureen Corrigan began wondering if the books people were reading in the Great Depression had any correspondence to our reading tastes today. She focused her investigation on one of the darkest years of the Great Depression, 1933. And here's what she found.
Publishers Weekly is the trade journal of the publishing industry. Various incarnations of the magazine have been around since 1852, and old issues are a marvel to skim through because they preserve the reading worlds of yesterday in amber. Not only do they starkly demonstrate how fleeting fame can be, but the old issues also provide plenty of opportunities for contemporary readers to condescend to the past. It's unsettling, for instance, to see in the Publishers Weekly issue of July 1933 an ad hawking Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, translated as My Battle, as a stirring autobiography in which you will find Hitler's own story of his meteoric rise from obscurity to worldwide fame. That same issue of the Publishers Weekly declares that the reading of books has increased throughout the Depression, as shown by library circulation records. At a quick glance, the popular books Americans were reading in the early 1930s look a lot like the mass market offerings of 2009. There's a furry precursor to the vampire mania of today lurking in an April 1933 bestseller called The Werewolf of Paris, and even a couple of canine ancestors of Marley and Me. The dog starring as Elizabeth Barrett Browning's spaniel Flush in the 1933 Broadway play The Barretts of Wimpole Street is depicted in a September 2nd photo spread putting his paw to a contract for a fictional memoir. That same month, Virginia Woolf cashed in on the Flush craze by bringing out a biography of the pooch. The ad promised that the forthcoming Shaggy Dog story was certain to be Mrs. Woolf's most popular book. Clearly, the copywriter was not a fan of Woolf's experiments in literary modernism. If you want to get a deeper sense, however, of the literary fantasies our fellow Americans were reaching for to help them cope with the economic meltdown of the 1930s, you've got to read between the lines of these yellowed Publishers Weekly magazines. Women then as now were turning to chick lit, with the crucial difference being that many of the 1930s plots featured plucky young women whose family fortunes had taken a nosedive. Faith Baldwin's novel, White Collar Girl, was deemed a circulation ace in May of 1933. It told the story of charming Linda, who was forced by her father's failure to leave college for a selling job in her upstate New York hometown. No doubt male readers were the target audience for the many economic primers of the time, such as Counterattack, written by Maryland Senator Millard E. Tydings, and touted as a bold, sound, feasible plan to end the Depression. But there were also a plethora of hard luck male extreme adventure tales published in the early 1930s, like Mutiny on the Bounty, Revolutionary War potboiler Rabble in Arms, and one of the biggest bestsellers of 1933, Anthony Adverse, which weighed in at over 1,000 pages. The allure of these novels seems pretty clear. Men who were struggling during the Great Depression could take comfort in reading about the exploits of stranded sailors, ragtag colonial soldiers, and a dispossessed nobleman who has to fight his way from Cuba to Africa to Europe and America to claim his rightful inheritance. Some of the most desperate tales in the Depression-era Publishers Weeklies are the ones only hinted at by ads and brief news items. Brentano's and the publisher Horace Liveright filed for bankruptcy. The Everyman's Library reduced its prices from 90 cents to 70 cents a volume. and three workers at Schulte's, a rare bookstore on New York's Fourth Avenue, went out on strike wearing sandwich boards, accusing the store of unfair practice because the owner tried to cut wages. Then there's this ad in the Positions Wanted section of the July 22, 1933 issue. Man, 25, 3 years experience, old, new books, library. Do anything, any salary. I wonder how he made out.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.